Their life was so insecure, never knowing of their husband's whereabouts or safety, that it was only natural that they should cling together, living from one short visit to another between sporadic telephone calls. The house was forever changing its shape and nature as husbands went missing on operations and babies were born. To me, arriving back for a weekend away from the war, it was worse than a madhouse. Sometimes, in a fury, I would drive away all the hangers on enjoying free meals and accommodation, leaving only the two or three original families who, once I had left, would immediately start building again. In time I became the enfant terrible and the villain of the commune. Air Chief Marshal, later Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Sir Arthur Harris, Commander-in-Chief Bomber Command. 5. Before the storm, I passed down this corridor, idly basking in old memories. At the end of it, I went through a door into a somber room whose far wall was in the shadows. I momentarily stopped and listened to the sound of muted whispers of unknown voices echoing in the darkness. Oh! I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings, sunward I've climbed, and joined the tumbling mirth of sunslit clouds, and done a hundred things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there I've chased the shouting wind along, and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up there long, delirious, burning blue I've topped the wind-swept heights with easy grace where never lark, or even eagle flew dash and, while with silent, lifting mind I've trod the high untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand, and touched the face of God. John Gillespie McGee Jr. The two chapters which follow, Before the Storm and The Storm, were written immediately after the events described and during a period of convalescence as I tried to put my thoughts and life in some sort of order. However, rather than clutter up pages with footnotes, I have added some historical detail which emerged later from other sources about this period. After a very brief refresher course at the Mosquito Operational Conversion Unit at TRAF, High Erk Hall in Shropshire, Bambi and I were posted to No 21 Squadron RAF Hunstone, Hertfordshire, a part of No 140 Wing. 21 Squadron was commanded by Wing Commander Daddy Dale, who had been the chief flying instructor at Penhold and whom I knew well. No 140 was a mixed Commonwealth wing composed of an Australian squadron, No 464, a New Zealand squadron, No 487, and No 21, which had a smattering of Canadians in it. We all got on very well together. The wing was a highly specialized low-level day and night force of some 80 Mosquito VI fighter, bomber aircraft. These carried four 250-pound bombs together with gun armament of four 20mm cannons and 4.303 machine guns. We had done no weapon training at Greenwood, and High Erk Hall had been supposed to remedy this. However, No 2 group had been so short of crews that the course was cut short and the following was entered into my logbook: this pilot is assessed as high average and commenced intruder training, but is now being passed out course not completed to an O2 group squadron. He lacks formation, low-level bombing and gunnery practice. On joining 21 Squadron I managed three low-level training sorties and three dive bombing sorties with 28 pounds practice bombs before going on my first operational trip, flying number 2 to Daddy Dale, the squadron commander. It was a daylight wing attack against a flying bomb site at Lahans and was the first time I had dropped a 250-pound bomb or fired my cannons. The effect was startling. The noise and smoke in the cockpit from the cannons were just as frightening as the enemy flak. It took me a number of operational sorties to get used to this experience. 140 Wing was involved in a number of spectacular raids requiring pinpoint low-level bombing accuracy, including that on the Amiens prison, Operation Jericho. The objective was to breach the prison walls and release the several hundred prisoners held there, some of them members of the French resistance awaiting execution. 18 Mosquitoes, 6 from each squadron led by the station commander, Group Captain Picard, already a famous pilot and star of the film F for Freddy, flew through the winter snow at treetop level to attack the prison. His aircraft was the only one to be shot down by German fighters, crashing in the gloom just a few miles from the prison. He was succeeded by another distinguished pilot, Group Captain Peter Wycombe Barnes, who would eventually retire, after a distinguished career, as an air marshal, having been decorated in the war with the DSO and BAR, DFC and BAR. Most of the missions in which we flew were night intruder operations flown against German airfields and aircraft, diverting the attention of the Luftwaffe away from attacking our main bomber force. This type of intrusion involved groping our way across Europe at low level, using whatever navigational clues were available. Once we reckoned that we were in the vicinity of the airfield we had come to attack, we were lucky to ever find one lit up. We climbed to about 4,000 feet and dived swiftly into the black hole ahead with the navigator calling out heights, 3,000, 2,000, 1,000 feet, bombs away. All this time, in order to avoid giving their position away, the Germans would keep quiet. Once bombs were gone, we were almost always automatically coned in searchlights and sprayed with exploding shells and tracer. The aircraft, bucking with freedom from its load, would be thrown into an escape route, throttles fully open, jinking and weaving as close to the ground as one dared. Each mission was an individual one, always flying at low level under the enemy defenses, even on the darkest night, and requiring a high degree of concentration. The first aircraft would take off into the last shreds of daylight, followed at short intervals by one and then another until the whole wing was airborne. From the north to the south and deep to the east, Europe became a battleground where neither village nor city, soldier or civilian were spared. On shorter missions we would often fly a second detail, using the long night to turn the aircraft around, refuel and attack again, only returning as the dawn began to break to crawl at last into dew-covered tents and a cold safari bed to try and sleep through the morning. Once, on a clear night deep over France, I picked up the silhouette of a large aircraft, flying close to the ground. We crept up behind it, primed the guns and then moved in slowly with a healthy respect for a possible tail gunner who must have been asleep. I wanted to be quite sure of an identification before firing and super caution made me go in even closer until the whole silhouette became quite clear. It was an RAF Stirling and I broke away in utter frustration, albeit relief. These aircraft were being used for dropping arms and supplies to the Mackie and were never cleared or announced beforehand. They relied on their stealth in the darkness to avoid friend and foe alike, and this one would never know just how lucky he had been. This became such a common occurrence that some brilliant staff officer in No2 Group devised a scheme whereby, before pressing the trigger, pilots were required to transmit on their radios, "Boogie, boogie, waggle your wings." If the target failed to oblige, you shot. Fine in theory, but no fun on a dark night with practical jokers at work and 200 or 300 aircraft in and out of cloud, some minding their own business, suddenly frantically waggling their wings in abject fear on hearing the "boogie, boogie, waggle your wings" call. The scheme lasted but a night or two and no doubt the staff officer concerned was promoted. We continued to stalk friend and foe alike. More and more frequently in late 1943 and early 1944 all three squadrons flew together as a wing on daylight missions against the flying bomb sites, which were codenamed no-ball targets, along the French coast. By the time of my first mission against a no-ball target, tactics had been fairly well established. The sites were normally constructed in woods or orchards, and consisted of a main launcher, which was easily recognizable, shaped like a ski or hockey stick and which the Germans made no effort to camouflage, together with 2 or 3 storage and assembly buildings. The site was defended by both light and heavy flak towers. The success of any mission depended upon accurate navigation, routing and detailed knowledge of gun defenses. It was the kind of flying pilots loved, skimming across the channel, churning up the waves with propeller tips, clipping the trees over France, 20 or 30 aircraft dancing across the countryside in open battle formation in a carefree ribbon of close comradeship. There were always a number of narrow gaps, some only 200 or 300 yards wide, in the chain of defenses along the coast where you could slip in under the radar defenses. Another tactic was to fly just above the crest of the waves to the coast, and then the whole wing would rocket up to 4,000 feet above light flak and then dive down again to treetop level. Although this cleared the gun defenses, enemy radar was able to pick us up and alert the fighters to lie in wait ahead. Flying as low as 50 feet above the ground to attack these targets, it was vital to make a straight-in approach at the correct angle to the aiming point and lob or skip the bombs into the buildings. It was like trying to flick a dart into the bullseye of a dartboard. Although the bombs were time-fused, it was necessary to maintain tight formation discipline to avoid being blown up by the bombs of the aircraft in front. One particular entry to a site area was marked by a wooden shed from which a stream of machine gun fire always greeted us, aimed by an unknown gunner nicknamed Hans Schmidt. To maintain this excellent navigation point, Hans Schmidt was permitted to continue his private war against the mosquitoes until Daddy Dale lost his temper one day and sprayed the shed with cannon fire. As we turned towards the target, a cow was seen to emerge from the shed and no more was heard from Hans Schmidt. Daddy Dale was not very popular thereafter with the rest of the wing. Because we were flying so close to the ground, damage from machine guns, light flak and even rifles was heavy. During the period of attacking these no-ball targets, No 2 Group flew nearly 5,000 sorties, lost 41 aircraft destroyed and 419 damaged by gunfire. It was not a rate we could sustain for long. By the end of May 1944, Allied Air Forces had destroyed over 103 sites, leaving only a very few operable, and the mosquitoes of our group had done the lion's share of the destruction. Required to move at short notice, the wing led a Spartan existence entirely under canvas. The purpose of inflicting such an uncomfortable existence on the aircrew was supposedly to toughen us up for the coming invasion of Europe, where we would be expected to leapfrog across Europe from airstrip to airstrip. Following the miserably cold winter of 1943-44, and in preparation for this invasion, we packed up our tents and moved from Roughunsdon to a dreadful old grass airfield in Gravesend, near London, where metal planking had been laid in lieu of a runway. Gravesend was an undulating field, and after the smooth concrete runway at Hunsdon, the mosquito with a full load did not take kindly to it. At night, when the undulations in the strip were invisible, it was easy to hop the mosquito along it like a kangaroo, becoming airborne only on the last bounce. We lost our American pilot Andy Wakeham this way one night, stalling his aircraft off the end of the strip into the Thames. On another occasion, a crew overshot into a field, demolishing a haystack which hid a land girl courting with one of our surprised and indignant ground crew. One early June morning, I came out of my tent around dawn and heard a noise in the air coming from the east unlike anything I had ever heard before. I could only describe it as not dissimilar to a motorbike engine, a staccato phut, phut. This winged creature flew eerily fast and low just to the north of the airfield, down the Thames in the direction of London. I knew immediately that the Germans had got their flying bombs operational and that we had failed to destroy them all on the ground. It was a terrible shock to actually see these obscene weapons flying over England. This was the start of the second Blitz, and from then on they came thick and fast, day and night, some directly over the airfield, so that it soon became impossible to operate properly. Once more we packed our tents into lorries and the wing took off like a swarm of bees for a safer hive, this time rough Thorny Island on the south coast. Each squadron lived in its own tented camp, grouped around three widely separated squadron aircraft dispersals. The wing only came together for meals in a large marquee erected on the lawn outside the permanent officers' mess, which was out of bounds to wing aircrew. Royal Air Force Thorny Island had been a well-established pre-war station, and the station officers worked in permanent brick buildings and lived, so we imagined, a life of old Riley in the officers' mess, It was rumored that they even enjoyed hot baths every day, whereas the wing air crew managed as best they could by drawing water from a bowser and heating it on Primus stoves. At night, through the well-lit windows, we could watch them eating and drinking in splendid comfort, which widened even further the division between aircrew and ground officers, leading to a contempt and ridicule on our side and a certain guilty sulkiness on theirs. The pattern of our life at Thorny Island was soon pretty well established. I shared a tent with Bambi. We normally rose at midday and assembled in the squadron dispersal to wait for the 20 hundredweight trucks to carry us around the perimeter track to the mess tent for lunch. Around the airfield the same was happening in the other squadron dispersals. Lunchtime was a social and happy part of the day when the whole wing gathered together for drinks and lunch. The life of the flying wing was so compressed in time that any terrors of the previous night had passed and the fears of the night to come were pushed into the background. Our conversation avoided reference to missing crews and faces and generally centered around flying. As the drink flowed, the talk in groups became more animated and the stories taller. I tell you, old boy, I dropped one right down the funnel of a train and it finished up the arse of the stoker. The flak was so accurate it would have brought a pigeon down, and so on. The previous month a crew from, I think, No. 464 Squadron, on a daylight sortie, had observed a troop train entering a mile-long tunnel. They proceeded to block the exit with two well-placed 250-pound bombs and then, with commendable initiative, closed the entrance with another salvo, bottling the train up inside. This story was the subject of much ribald humor for weeks as crews tried to cap it. Daddy Dale was considerably older than most of the rest of the wing. One of the few pre-war pilots, he had been involved in a serious aircraft accident which had left him with a gammy leg and a large dent in the top of his head. Indeed, he had a great deal of difficulty climbing in and out of the small entrance and cramped cockpit of the Mosquito. He was one of the nicest and kindest senior officers I had ever met and reveled in operational flying. In peacetime he had been extremely keen on hunting and looked on the whole business of war as an extension of hunting, with Germans as the prey. He was also very absent-minded and a natural butt for the practical jokes of the much younger officers, all of which he took with gentle good humor. These practical jokes generally centered around Daddy's dent. He always parked his staff car just outside it and at least once a week someone tied a guy rope to the bumper and Daddy Dale took off across the airfield trailing his tent behind him. It always worked and kept the wing in hoots of laughter. I sometimes suspected that he knew what was happening but continued to express surprise and fury to keep us all amused. Ground officers seldom penetrated such tightly knit groups whose gossip and repartee had produced its own special slang. The working day began just after lunch, when the station became alive as group orders were digested and dissected into wing and squadron details according to the availability of aircraft and crews. Around the dispersals the ground staff would still be working on maintenance, patching and repairing aircraft after the previous night's operations, the silence only broken by the noise of engine runs and air tests. Later on, bombing up and arming would be heralded by a long line of trolleys snaking around the perimeter track from the main bomb dump to individual dispersals. For Bambi and I, this would be tent tidying time, airing and making our safari beds, tucking away yesterday's laundry into a dirty linen bag, checking guy ropes and pegs and, if time permitted, writing letters, in fact all the domestic chores familiar to campers. If there was an air test to do, crews would be called out but normally we only air tested our own aircraft. We would then make our own tea on a Primus stove in the tent before stacking personal belongings in a neat pile on the shared folding table, photographs, letters, wallets. Each of us was responsible for ensuring that the other carried no information which would give away the location or tasks of the wing if we were taken prisoner. It also made the collection of personal effects much easier if crews went missing. The main briefing took place just after 4 o'clock in a large tent near the main control tower, where over 100 aircrew jammed in to hear the wing specialists cover the meteorological report, the tactical situation and battle plan for the night, together with the update on enemy fighter and gun deployments. Then, after an early supper, crews dispersed to their own squadron briefing tents, where individual crews were allocated targets and the time to be over them. Now the largely physical activity of the day gave way to a different kind of concentration as pilots and navigators pored over charts, plotting enemy defenses and courses. As we got further into 1944, the pattern of operations began to change perceptibly away from attacking Luftwaffe airfields to attacking logistic targets and communications with bombs and guns. The fingers which had previously stretched out nightly far into Europe began to close into a clenched fist, punching away at targets along and behind the French coast, railway sidings, bridges and military headquarters, whilst still keeping up the daylight attacks on the flying bomb sites. With the shorter distances to fly, it was now often possible to get in two and even three sorties a night. As the pressures built up, so the casualties mounted. On two occasions I returned to base on one engine, and on another was diverted to Manston Airfield on the Kentish coast minus a wing tip. The Mosquito was a delightful aircraft to fly, fast and maneuverable. We generally cruised at about 220 miles per hour at 10,000 feet. It was thought unwise to mix it with a single engine fighter, although some pilots did, but, given height, it was possible to outdive a fighter and escape at low level. Built entirely of wood, Uchuk shells could sometimes go right through the fuselage or wings of the aircraft without exploding, but light stuff close to the ground could be lethal. In comparison with other contemporary aircraft, the Mosquito had a high landing speed and could be tricky at the lower speeds when landing on one engine with full flaps down. In this period I had three squadron friends who were killed on operations: Michael Wedgwood Benn, brother of Anthony Wedgwood Benn, the Labour politician, who overshot the runway and drowned trapped in the cockpit in the shallow water just off the airfield; Bill Adams, whose Mosquito blew up near the airfield returning from a sortie; and John Farrelly, who ploughed through the airfield control wagon at the end of the runway when landing on one engine. My great friend from Canada days, Flight Lieutenant Trevor Woods, was also killed on another Mosquito intruder squadron. I mention this because later on he paid me a surprise visit. One night a squadron truck taking aircrew to the mess along the perimeter track drove into the propeller of a taxiing Mosquito, scattering bits of bodies around the airfield. At this stage of the war there was no shortage of aeroplanes; indeed, as one was lost, another was flown in almost immediately by a ferry pilot from a maintenance unit to replace it. The problem was replacing experienced crews. At one point the wing was so desperately short that when two pilots were temporarily attached to the wing for airfield control duties, pending posting to the operational conversion units, one of the squadrons, like the old press gang, grabbed them and trained them up with two spare navigators as Mosquito crews. Unfortunately, when they came to be posted to their OCUs they had already become battle casualties and there was hell to pay from the Air Ministry. And so the war went on. Because it was so difficult on a moonless night to find the target visually, it was decided as a trial to fit three or four wing aircraft with a blind navigation and bombing aid called GH. Bambi and I were chosen to go on a week's course at RAF Swanton Morley in Norfolk to learn how to operate it, and this was a welcome break. We did five bombing sorties on Mosquitoes and three on Mitchells during the week, before returning to the squadron fully trained on the equipment. This decision to fit GH on our fighter bomber Mosquitoes was hotly disputed by those pilots with night fighter experience, of which there were a number on the wing. Since the procedure involved flying for some time at a constant height and airspeed along a curve, releasing bombs on a pre-computed signal, it was relatively easy for enemy radar to plot the course and vector night fighters onto the target. This was not so bad for bombers properly armed and crewed against fighter threat, but in our aircraft with the navigator's head buried in the black box and the pilot concentrating on his instruments for what had to be very accurate flying, the rear of the aircraft was totally devoid of lookout or defenses. However, we returned to Thorny Island and continued flying the normal missions, waiting for our aircraft to be modified with the GH equipment. A fortnight before D-Day, the wing was confined to base and the ground crew began painting black and white stripes on wings and fuselage for easy identification when the battle for Europe started in earnest. As dusk fell on the night before D-Day, we assembled in great excitement for the detailed briefing on the landings and our part in the invasion. The number 2 group force of Bostons, Mitchells and Mosquitoes were to be concentrated around the beachhead and behind it, attacking day and night all movement on the ground, sterilizing the front by preventing any reinforcement into the battle area by rail, road or waterway. Our first sortie on D-night was to patrol an area far behind the beachhead to avoid giving our position away. On our flight at about 1,000 feet across the channel, we were hotly engaged by the Navy, firing off the color of the night only intensified their fire. Fortunately, they were not very accurate and we were not hit. Later in the night, like a falcon among a flock of pigeons, we flew through a gaggle of Albemarle transport aircraft and gliders, which startled all of us. This proved to be a party of the 6th Airborne Division who were to seize the bridges over the Canal de Caen and River Orne. Even later we skirted around the 2 parachute brigades, 3rd and 5th, on their way to drop east of Orne. Filling in my logbook the next morning, D-Day, I wrote, 6 June Mosquito T-Self F, O Gun. Patrol 1,000 feet road and railway LS Yux Everux. Strafed and shot up staff car on road. Bombed bridge over railway. No results observed. Scattered flak, several fires in area. Strafed and set train on fire. And a second sortie, Mosquito T Self F, O Gun. Area covered by mist and cloud. Bombed railway junction. Lys Yux burning. Fires over the area. One cast raft. Light flak and rockets. We now flew up to 3 patrols a night, bombing and cannoning anything which moved. The poor Jerry soldier only had to light a cigarette to be pounced on. Our orders were to stop all movement by night, and this included the secondary roads leading to the front along which weary German troops crawled during the hours of darkness. This was not too difficult on a moonlit night when it was easy to pick up roads, rivers and railways, but the weather in June 1944, was appalling and we were forced to fly lower and lower under the cloud in pitch darkness over the rolling countryside of Normandy looking for targets, breaking all the rules regarding safety heights. On these dark and dirty nights it was impossible to see other patrolling aircraft although you knew they were there, 100 or so aircraft in a very small and crowded airspace. Every now and again a German night fighter got into the hive and stirred it up by attacking one of the patrolling aircraft and then everyone started firing, sometimes at each other, and the sky was crisscrossed by tracer, only to settle down again after a time as everyone continued about their business. But for the most part the Luftwaffe were conspicuous by their absence. Our aircraft were modified with radio altimeters which helped considerably in judging heights during night attacks. We also began to carry our own flares for illuminating targets. Fatigue was still the worst enemy. On one particular sortie, in company with another Mosquito flown by a Polish crew, we were alternately attacking a train with cannons, diving from about 1,500 feet and pulling out very low. As I was flying down the side of the train, setting myself up for a further attack, I watched the other aircraft dive onto it and then never pull out, flying straight into the target with an enormous explosion, illuminating the sky and the hordes of German soldiers hurriedly debarking from the train and spreading out over the countryside. I suspect a lot of our casualties were due to fatigue and the extremely bad weather. During this period, typical entries in my logbook read, Mosquito T Self F, O Gun Night Patrol 1,000 feet Knfalays Road. Weather poor, strafed for it on Glay twice, large explosion. bombed lights in wood and fires observed. Strafed train and returned on one engine. And, Mosquito T self and F, O gun patrol 1,000 feet roads south of Kn. Shot up convoy of four vehicles. Bombed and strafed Panzer element. Strafed one train. Light flak.